Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
When we think about the greatest NFL players that wore the jersey number 60, there's a lot of forgotten players there. Well, we have a specialist in Sports Forgotten Heroes host Warren Rogan's going to help us remember them, jersey number 60s, and we'll come up with a top 10 coming up in a moment. This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. This is your host, Darren Hayes, and we are podcasting from America's North Shore, bringing you the memories of the gridiron, one day at a time. So in taking the snap from the sportshistorynetwork.com and handing off to pigskindispatch.com, let's go no huddle through today's football history headlines.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and welcome once again to the Pigpen for a special bonus edition, our Football by Number series. Jersey number 60 is up tonight, and we have our friend Warren Rogan with us to help us find a top 10 greatest number 60s in NFL history. Warren Rogan, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Hey, Darren, thanks for having me. Should be a lot of fun. All of these have been fun. I love the conversations. And number 60 is going to be interesting.
Yeah, we're definitely in the heart of the big guys in the trenches. That's for sure.
Yeah, you know, it's very difficult, I think, to judge a lot of these guys because they're offensive linemen. And it's very difficult to measure what they've done or how valuable they really are when you can't just compile statistics. So a lot of this is from memory, from watching them, from reading about them. And then, you know, we do have the one sneaky one who is at the top that, you know, he is the greatest number 60 as far as I'm concerned.
I think we're probably agreeing on the same person too. And he is a sneaky one. You wouldn't expect him to be in there, but he is.
No.
So, well, let's reveal our Hall of Famers. It's a good place to start. And the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton tells us there are four Hall of Famers that wore jersey number 60. And they are Otto Graham, Bill Willis, Dick Stanfill, and Chuck Bednarek.
Chuck Bednarek, and I actually worked with him once.
Did you really?
On an infomercial.
Okay, so I'm messing his name up. How do you say that again?
Chuck Bednarek.
Bednarek, okay. I was making one of the consonants silent. Okay, we'll have to get that correct. Well, is that a good place you want to start, or did you want to kick your top 10 off, and we'll compare top 10s and go from there?
Okay, we could let's go 10. I'll do a countdown for you from number 10. I like doing it that way.
Okay.
Because I know that when you get started 10, that's where most of the disagreement will be. My number 10, and we could, you know, you want to stop it right there. You want to continue, go, let me do my 10. You do your 10, however you want to do it. You just stop me. My number 10, Max Unger.
Okay.
My number 9, got to be a giant in there, Sean O'Hara. And he's a really interesting story. Number 8, Dennis Hara. Number 7, Roy Winston. Number 6, a Hall of Famer, Dick Stanfill. Number 5, Al Bubba Baker. Number 4, Larry Grantham. Number 3, Bill Willis. Number 2, Chuck Bednarek. And you could probably make a pretty good argument to get him to number 1, but I think it'd be really difficult to say Otto Graham is not the greatest number 60 of all time.
I agree with you. I'll tell you what, we're real close. I have two that are different from you, and they're almost in the exact same order. That's really scary.
Okay.
But I had Sean O'Hara at 10. I put Chris Samuels in at number 9. Max Unger, I left off. I told you I had 12 before we started here. Max Unger, I left off there, and I was heartbroken about it here. I had Tommy Nobis as a 7th, Dennis Hara, Bubba Baker, Larry Grantham, Dick Stanfield, Bill Willis, Chuck Bednarik, and Otto Graham. So very close, one or two off.
Yeah, really close. I mean, it's very difficult, I think, when you look at the careers of obviously Graham, obviously Bednarik, and Bill Willis to say that they aren't the three top number 60s of all time. And I'm sure a lot of football fans out there have probably never heard of Bill Willis. Largely because most of his time was in the AAFC. And it's a really interesting, I don't know if you call it a conundrum, discussion issue, but I find it really interesting that, you go to baseball and now players who compiled statistics in the Negro Leagues, their careers, those numbers are considered major league numbers. The Federal League, those numbers are considered major league numbers, and they count towards their major league careers. For whatever reason, the NFL has not accepted the numbers compiled in the All-America Football Conference as official numbers. So a guy like Bill Willis, who played most of his career with the Browns in the AAFC, a lot of what he did is not considered towards his overall record, but he certainly was an outstanding lineman for the Cleveland Browns. Some of that stuff's really interesting.
Yeah, it definitely is. And, I always found that odd too. The AFL, they ended up using their statistics because they merged. AAFC, I guess you could call it a merge or a takeover and kicking a bunch of teams out, but similar to a merge, but they don't let those records in.
You had the Browns. Mm-hmm. And you had the Niners. Those were the two big teams that came into the NFL from the AAFC. The Colts did as well, but a year later. So it was more like the franchise name came in. But I think it's really insulting to the Cleveland Browns that their numbers didn't transfer in, as you know, and a lot of that was because they felt that the AAFC was so inferior, yet the Browns, when they came in, they won the NFL championship. So there was nothing inferior about the Cleveland Browns of the AAFC. And really the only team that could contend with the Browns during those AAFC years were the Niners, and their numbers were not absorbed either. And I just find that it shouldn't be that way. Those numbers should transfer in, but they don't. And that's our conversation.
But I'm wondering if maybe there's in the near future, there'll be a change, because I was at the Pro Football Hall of Fame 2 weeks ago, and something that I go probably every couple of years. There's a lot of changes there since I was there. They've done a lot of adding on and remodeling. But right when you walk in, there is a display of the USFL players, and they're giving some recognition to them. There's some other displays of recognizing some other leagues where they're talking about players that played in that league, which I don't remember if I ever saw that before at the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Usually it was, AFL and NFL only. And I found that to be kind of interesting.
Yeah. I don't think they'll ever absorb the USFL numbers. If they do and they don't absorb the AAFC, I mean, that would be the ultimate, ultimate slap in the face.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. But I think their big conundrum is, what do you do then with the CFL and some of the other leagues that, XFLs and.
Yeah, those are the CFL is an entity unto itself. Very little crossover. I think they used to have some exhibition games. The XFL, those are, I hate to say minor league players, but those are minor league players. CFL players, there are definitely some great CFL players that have gone back and forth. Warren Moon, Doug Flutie, Jack Kemp. There have been some great players who go back and forth, but you had a full team. You had two full teams go from the AAFC to the NFL, and you go, you look at the NHL, where you had the four teams from the World Hockey Association, Edmonton, Winnipeg, Hartford, and Quebec. Their numbers were absorbed. And the ABA, when they went over, you had the Nets, the Pacers, the Nuggets, and the Spurs. Their numbers all went over. So you would think that somehow, some way, the NFL will ultimately right a wrong. And if they do, our number one on the number 60 list, Otto Graham, his numbers will be even greater.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. Now, it's interesting. I mean, I guess maybe that's where we started discussions with Otto Graham. But it's interesting. His number was 60 in the AAFC. And he, because of the AAFC coming in, they didn't really have any number restrictions. The NFL adopted a rule, I believe, in the early 50s, 51 or 52, where they were sort of where they were up to like 2 years ago in the NFL, where quarterbacks can only wear a certain number and receivers. Now that's since expired with this new rule this year, where sort of all bets are off except for interior linemen. But that's where that came from. And that's why Otto Graham had to change his number from 60 to 14. Okay.
Yeah. The interesting thing is he wore 60 for 10 years. So his first couple of years in the NFL, he actually did wear number 60. And ultimately, they assigned numbers, interior linemen had to be in the, the 50s or the 60s. So they made him switch. So while most of his career was wearing number 60, he did wear number 14, and it's the number 14 that the Browns did retire. But he wore 60 for, a number of seasons, and he was about as good as it. He wore 60 for 6 years, 14 for 4 years, and he was about as good as it gets during his playing days.
Yeah. So what was it? If 60 was his number for his first 6 years, he had five championships in those 6 years wearing number 60.
Yeah. So he won the AAFC every year. There was an AAFC.
So there's four.
46, 47, 48, and 49. And then he went over to the NFL his first year in the NFL. He led the Browns to the NFL championship. So he won the NFL championship in 50. Believe they went back in 51 and they lost.
Right.
And he won the NFL championship again in 54 and in 55. So I think he won seven times.
Right. But I'm saying with the number 60, those 6 years.
Oh, yeah.
He had five championships, I believe. Yeah, and he played in another championship game that he lost.
Yeah. I mean, so.
So 60 was pretty good to him.
Yeah, he won five in a row, 46, 47, 48, 49, and 50, and went to a sixth but didn't win. He was a great ball player, great, great quarterback. Won the AAFC MVP twice, won the NFL MVP three times. When you take a look – at his overall career record, he won 57 games and lost 13. In the AAFC, you know, Paul Brown put together one of the most dominant, one of the most phenomenal football teams of all time. And, you know, when we talk about the undefeated teams, which were the Miami Dolphins, their perfect year, 72, when they went 17-0, including the Super Bowl, and, you know, the Patriots, who went 16-0, then lost the Super Bowl to the Giants. The Browns were an undefeated team, but they don't get the recognition as an undefeated team. They went 14-0 in 1948. So his 4 years in the AAFC, 12-2, 12-1-1, 14-0, 9-1-2. So over 4 years, he lost four games. It's
wow,
unheard of. So yeah, in 1950, the Browns' first year in the NFL, they went 10-2. They beat the Giants in the divisional round of the playoffs, and they beat the Los Angeles Rams in the NFL championship game 30-28. And, you know, that was just the sweetest of victories for the fans of Cleveland, because not only were they able to prove that their Browns, their team in Cleveland, was the best in football, they also beat the team that left Cleveland and went to Los Angeles, the Rams. So it was, you know, a great win, sort of gave legitimacy to the AAFC. You know, he was his overall playoff record, 9-3, 7 championships. Every year of his 10-year career, he was in the playoffs. Statistically, completed over 55% of his passes, threw a bunch of interceptions, but he threw a lot more touchdowns. He 174 touchdowns. You know, the Browns is they you know, they had Jim Brown, obviously, so they had a heck of a running game, but they weren't afraid to air it out. And he threw 174 touchdowns, 135 interceptions, but he was really good with the ball in his hands too, running it, and he scored 44 touchdowns. He was just an overall great player. And, you know, he was a great college ball player too. He played at Northwestern. He was the Big Ten Player of the Year in 43. And, yeah, I don't know the full story as to why he went to the Browns instead of the Lions, who drafted him. And, you know, the Lions weren't a bad football team at that time. They're not like the Lions of today. They drafted him 4th overall. But Paul Brown was able to offer him a little more money, $7,500. So maybe that's what it came down to. And, you know, there might have been a little something to do with World War II. I'm a little fuzzy on that, but he, like I said, was a great, great athlete. So good, in fact, he played professional basketball as well. A lot of people don't know that. Huh. Before there was an NBA, there was what was called the BAA, which was the Basketball Association of America, and there was what was called the NBL, the National Basketball League, and they merged to form the NBA. And when they, right before they did that, Otto Graham played for the Rochester Royals. And he came off the bench and averaged 5.2 points per game. And he helped them win a championship. Imagine that. This guy just had this championship pedigree. He helped them win a championship over Sheboygan. So he was just a phenomenal athlete. I think the greatest ever to wear number 60 in professional football. He was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1965. He also went on to coach. He coached the Redskins for a couple of years without a whole lot of success. I think it was 3 years, and he was like 17 and 22 with a few ties.
Yeah, I mean, that's all really amazing stuff. He is such an interesting player. And he played defense, too, in his first 3 years with the Browns, had seven interceptions. He played defensive back. I mean, how can you say anything bad about that? A guy that's a star quarterback that also has some picks. So that's some great things. A couple of things I just wanted to add. We have a lot of fans for Cleveland here in Erie. They're less than 100 miles away. And I always tell people that, you know, they were upset when the Browns left. And I can understand that when they left in the late 90s. And when LeBron James left the first time. And I understand why they were upset there. But I said, how about when the Cleveland Rams win a championship and they leave and go to LA? I mean, you left and when you won a championship, that's really got to put a knife in your heart when that happens.
In 45, they win the championship, and within a month or two, they were out in LA. Crazy.
That would be like the Buccaneers leaving Tampa Bay right now. You know, it's just nuts. Yeah. Those people would go crazy. Yeah. So,
and that was the second, I think the second time a team left Cleveland that was in the NFL. So I think Cleveland has had three times teams have left. There was a team prior to the Rams, and the Rams left, then the Browns left, and now you have the Browns again. So
yeah, you had the Cleveland Indians, the Cleveland Bulldogs when they took over, the Indians took over the Canton team at one point. And then went back to Canton. Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah. Crazy back then. But I think we both agreed on that Otto Graham is definitely the number one player wearing 60 in NFL history. That's for sure.
No doubt. And
what a stud.
And I think a close number two, really a close number two, is Chuck Bednarik. He played for the Eagles. He had an interesting nickname, and a lot of people think that nickname had to do with how hard he hit on the field, and it actually didn't, but it was a nickname that was absorbed because of that as well. His nickname was Concrete Charlie, and it was because of the fact that he was a concrete salesman during the off season. Remember, back in the day, a salary for most of these guys, 99.9% of them couldn't sustain them for their lifestyle, you know, to make a full year's living. So a lot of these guys had to work during the off season, and Chuck Bednarik was a concrete salesman. So, but he was one heck of a player, made one of the most famous tackles in the history of football in 1960 against the Giants. He hit Frank Gifford so hard, some people actually thought Gifford was dead. He just lay motionless on the field. And as you would expect, the hit caused a fumble. Gifford actually did not play football for another 18 months after that hit. He basically broke him in half.
Wow.
And the amazing thing about the hit is Gifford didn't hold a grudge against Bednarik. He said, it was a clean hit. It was the cleanest of hits. He just got me good, and he knocked him out for 18 months. So Chuck was part of two NFL championship teams with the Eagles, 1949 and 1960. Eight times he was a Pro Bowl player. 10 times he was named to the NFL first team All-Pro. He was named to the NFL's 50th all-time anniversary team, their 75th anniversary team, their 100th anniversary team. Guy was just great. 1950s all-decade team. He was inducted into the Football Hall of Fame in 1967. Over the course of his career, he had 20 interceptions, 21 fumble recoveries. In 14 years, he only missed three games. And he was a linebacker. He was a center. His number 60 is retired by the Eagles. And, you know, he was a really smart dude, too. He was the first overall pick in the draft out of the University of Pennsylvania.
So go Quakers.
Yeah, the Quakers had a number one pick in the draft. You know, he was a smart guy. He was a good guy. He played the game tough. He played the game the right way. I had an opportunity at one time many years ago to work with him on an infomercial. This was way back in the early 1990s. You know, he was a good guy. An interesting fact about him too was he was a staff sergeant in the Air Force from 1942 to 1946. And he flew 30 combat missions in World War II before he started his NFL career.
So, see, he wasn't at all a youngster when he came to the NFL. I did not know.
No, he wasn't. Like I said, he played 14 years. If he added it all up, he could have probably had about a 17, 18-year career.
Wow, amazing. So, okay, now I have to ask the question that everybody's probably thinking. You have a guy with a nickname of Concrete Charlie doing an infomercial. Was it like some kind of a cleaner or something that would clean concrete? Or
I'm going to be honest with you. I'm racking my brains out. I cannot remember the product. It was so long ago. I knew you were going to ask me this, and it was so long ago. I can't remember the product. I can't remember.
Well, if you remember it, you know, after the show, we'll post it in the show notes to give everybody the answer, because that's going to eat away at me now.
Yeah, I'll have to look it up. You know, I'll do a little search. But I can't. I was saying, you know, if I bring this up, he's going to ask me, and I can't remember what it was, but I can remember doing the infomercial.
That's getting scary. That means you've been on talking with me quite a bit, so you know how my brain thinks, and you know, you know it's poisoned. It's going to go tilted somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we definitely agree on Bednarik being the second player on our roster. I think we both agreed on the third one with Bill Willis.
Yeah, he was a defensive lineman also for those great Browns teams. He wore number 30 his first 6 years and number 60 his last two. So he did play some offensive line for the Browns as well. So basically, Otto Graham needed to give up his number 60 for Bill Willis. He played on those AAFC championship teams of 46, 47, 48, and 49. And he played for the Browns when they won their championship in 1950 in the NFL. He was three times named to the he was first team all pro three times in the AAFC. Three times he played Pro Bowl in the NFL. He four times he was first team all pro in the NFL. All decades team of the 1940s. He is in the Browns Ring of Honor. We know why he played in the AAFC as opposed to Otto Graham. Like I said, Otto Graham, you know, a little fuzzy. There was a money thing. Paul Brown offered him $7,500. I don't don't know what the Lions offered him. I'm sure back in the day, in the mid 40s, $7,500 was a real chunk of money. And, you know, the World War II was going on at the time as well. So I'm not sure how that played in Otto Graham's decision to go to the Browns. But really, Bill Willis, who was just, you know, he was a great college football player for Ohio State. He was not drafted because of the color of his skin. The AAFC didn't care. They wanted to establish a great football league, and they did, because they opened their doors to all races, all creeds, whatever it was. If you could play the game, you were welcome to play in the AAFC. So that's why he ended up in the AAFC playing for the Browns. And again, I think we've discussed this before. Paul Brown was just smarter than everybody else at the time, and he put together a heck of a team. So, when Willis played at Ohio State, he actually wore two different numbers. He wore number 0 and he wore number 99, both ends of the spectrum, and both numbers are retired. Ohio State retired both numbers, his number 0 and his number 99, and voted into the Hall of Fame in 1977 and is considered to be one of the most dominant defensive players, particularly of his time.
So the Ohio State players last year, when college went back to allowing number 0, they were kind of disappointed they couldn't grab it then, I'll bet.
Yeah, there you go, yeah.
But, you know, something interesting, and it's something we talked about earlier in the segment. Now, Willis was the Hall of Fame all 1940s team. He didn't play in the NFL in the 1940s. He played in the AAFC.
He's considered the NFL all-decade team of the 1940s. So you saw that as well.
Yeah, and he didn't play in the NFL then.
And he didn't play in the NFL. His stats from the AAFC don't count, but he was recognized by being named to their all-decades team. So, you know, it's a little fuzzy there. And I don't know how they came up with that, why it's good in one area and not in the other.
The only thing I can think of is if they count 1950 as being the 40s, you know, like if you were starting at, you know, 1901 to 1910, they didn't have an NFL, I understand, but you would count 1910. That's the only thing I can even think of.
That wouldn't make sense to me, because you would go 40 to 49 would be the 40s. And does 1 year qualify you for an all decades team? I don't know the NFL's formula for that.
I think I'm just going to go, he was that good. Even though he didn't play in the league, he was one of the best players. Exactly. So, and that's probably anybody could stand on that ground. That's for sure. Yeah. Cool. What a great player he was too. And Paul Brown, a genius, you know, just putting together. There's two players with number 60 that played on the same team that are making this list in the top three.
Yeah.
Tells you how good he was.
Exactly.
Okay. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, my number 4, I don't recall. This is where we diverge a little. I had Larry Grantham.
And I had Stanfill, but I think we just reversed him, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
Grantham was an absolutely terrific linebacker. He was as tough as can be to run the ball against. He played for the New York Titans, who later became the New York Jets. So the Titans changed their nickname to the Jets. And one of the real, like I said, as tough as nails, was an AFL All-Star 5 times. Ended up in the NFL with the Jets, helped them to the Super Bowl III victory over the Baltimore Colts, the famous victory. And ironically, it was the Colts who drafted him to play in the NFL, but he decided to go to the AFL, to the Jets. 5 times, he was first team All-AFL. He is in the Jets Ring of Honor. Played his college ball at Ole Miss. And He is one of only 20 players to have played all 10 years of the AFL's existence.
So probably Mr. Bland has got to be one of the other ones.
Yeah, I think he might be. I believe Billy Cannon might have been. Mm-hmm. Well, there are several of them, 20, but Larry Grantham, definitely one of them.
Interesting. Very interesting. You know, I just had 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago at the PFRA convention at the Pro Football Hall of Fame, they had a panel of guests on there. And you're talking about Super Bowl III. They had Bob Vogel, who was an offensive tackle for the Colts in the late 60s, early 70s. And he was asked that question about, you know, hey, did you guys go into Super Bowl III like super cocky or what it was? He goes, you know what? He goes, it was probably our best week of practice we had in like five seasons that week before the Super Bowl. They were focused. They went in there and he said the Jets just came in and just, you know, beat them to every dime, you know, just knocked them off the ball and played their butts off and beat them. So I found that was kind of interesting that, you know, the opponent of the Jets would say that.
Joe Namath, I'm not going to tell the story because I know I'm going to get the facts wrong, but Joe Namath has, anybody's got to look it up. He's got such great stories about the week leading up to the Super Bowl, including the hotel he stayed in, and including, I believe there might have been a part of the game where he didn't play and someone was asking him about questions about that. And they're showing video of him and he's going, I don't remember those plays. I think it might've been the Super Bowl. And sure enough, for whatever reason, that part of the Super Bowl, the film was lost and somehow this was put in there and it actually never happened. Like the backup quarterback or something was in the game. Something crazy like that.
Oh,
so,
really?
You got to go back and, well, let's just see something. I'm going to go to Super Bowl III statistics and let's see if there was another quarterback that played at all for the Jets that day. Sorry to diverge.
Please. We got to get this straightened out here.
Let's see. Here's the box scores coming up. Yeah, Babe Parilli was in the game. So Babe Parilli actually was in the game that day as a quarterback for the Jets. So I don't know. I can't recall if that's part of the story, but there's something about that. They were asking Namath about some plays, and they're saying, but it's you. And he goes, no, man, I don't remember that at all. Oh, got to find that story someplace. Good stuff.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I've never heard that one before. That is interesting. Okay. So, I mean, we both have Larry Grantham on the list, just a reverse order. Now, did you have Stanfield number five then?
I know. Actually, I moved, even though he's in the Hall of Fame, I got him dropped one more spot. I have him down at six. My number five is Bubba Baker, Bubba Baker. And I think he is a terribly overlooked superstar. He played 13 years in the NFL from 1978 to 1990. He played for the Lions, the St. Louis Cardinals, the Browns, and the Vikings. He had, in 1978, the NFL still didn't record sacks as an official statistic. And that year, he had 23 sacks, including five against Tampa in one game. He had, for his career, 65 and a half official sacks, and that includes 13 in 1983. That was, his career high outside of the 23 for the Rams in 83. Three times he was a Pro Bowler, All-Pro in 78. The same year he won Rookie of the Year, and that's the year he had 23 3 sacks. So
wow.
In his first 4 years where they didn't count everything official, it wasn't an official statistic, in his first 4 years, he had 67 sacks. I mean, just – he was a force, an absolute force. And when I was looking back at everything, it got me wondering, you know, is he an overlooked guy for the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, I think he is. I mean, you're telling me if he had 63 and some odd sacks in his first 4 years, it didn't count. And, you know, 65 and a half, he had, you know, 130 some sacks in his career. That's up there with the big guys.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to look up his overall stats right now, and it's pretty impressive. Let's see. Let's go to Bubba Baker. And you take a look, they didn't start counting sacks until 1982. And from 1982 to 1990, he had 65 and a half sacks. But they say unofficially, between 78, 79, 80, and 81, he had 67 sacks. So that's what, 132 sacks over the course of his 13-year career. 4 interceptions, you know, 8 fumble recoveries. He played in 7 playoff games over the course of his career. Never won a Super Bowl, didn't play for the greatest of teams. But, you know, he registered 2 sacks when he played for the Browns in 1987, he had a sack in each of their games. I think he actually could be an overlooked player. And I wonder if he is actually in the PFRA's Hall of Very Good.
I think he is. If I'm not mistaken, I think he is. But just that sack total. Okay, so we're right around 132, 133. Lawrence Taylor is tied for 14th in career sacks at 132 and a half. That shows you the caliber of sacks that the man had.
Not all of his sacks were counted right. Either. Right?
That's true. That's true.
This year or two, it was not an official stat either.
And just for the record, Bruce Smith leads the way with 200 sacks. Reggie White, 198. So those are some big numbers.
No doubt. So I had Bubba, you know, a pretty cool story about him. He appeared on Shark Tank in 2013 with his daughter. They came up with a product, and it apparently did very well. I don't know if it's still out there. It's called Bubba's Boneless Ribs.
I remember that.
Product that allows you to remove the bones from a fully intact slab of ribs so you can eat the ribs with a fork and a knife.
Yeah, I remember that episode being on there because I was going to try to find that product. I think that would you'd be an instant millionaire with something like that, because that's one of the most painful parts is trying to get the meat off those bones.
Yeah, you know, I'm looking at the Hall of Very Good and I don't see him in there. Really interesting.
Well, we may have to nominate him this year.
Yeah, maybe you and I should do it together.
Yeah, we should. He definitely deserves to be recognized somehow, because that's he was a great player.
Yeah, no doubt.
Probably should be in Canton.
Where did you have him on your list?
I end up having him at 6.
Okay, my number 6 is Dick Stanfield. So our top 6 are the same, with just 4, 5, and 6 a little
skewed, but no, you could. Yeah. I have no problem with the order you put them in. It's a horse apiece there, because they're all so good.
So Stanfield was a guard for the Lions in Washington. He wore 63 with the Lions and number 60 with the Redskins. Oh, am I allowed to say that? Washington football team, excuse me. five times he was in the Pro Bowl, five times he was first team all pro. We said this earlier, the Lions were actually a really good football team when Stanfield played. In fact, he helped them win two NFL championships in 1952 and 1953, back-to-back NFL championships for the Detroit Lions. Boom. Oh, my gosh. Figure that out. Yes, once upon a time, the Lions were really good.
Okay, be careful, because if our friend Arnie Chapman's listening to this, his head might just explode here, you know? I want to get him too excited here.
Yeah. We'll see how they do this year with a certain quarterback under center. But anyway, they were really good, and he was just a great offensive lineman, helped them to two NFL championships. He was voted to the 1950s All-Decade Team. He is in the Hall of Fame 2016. And, you know, he retired early. He just had a lot of injuries, including a spinal injury. And at the age of 31, he finally had to hang it up. Interestingly enough, they won the 52 NFL championship. They won the 53 NFL championship, and that was a year they beat the great Cleveland Browns, a year that they went 10-2. And he said the greatest honor of his career was being named the team MVP in 1953. Hmm. So he was really all for the team, a team player. Again, very difficult to talk about stats for an offensive lineman. But I will say this, he did coach a tiny bit as a head coach with the Saints when he replaced Mike Ditka after Ditka's brief stint with the Saints. He coached a lot for Ditka. He coached those Bears teams, those great Bear teams that wound up winning the Super Bowl in 85. And Ditka said that, without question, Dick Stanfield was the greatest offensive line coach he had ever worked with.
Hmm.
Pretty high praise. Pretty high praise.
Yes, it certainly is, with some of the great linemen that he had on his teams that both he played with and coached. So very high praise indeed. Yeah, the reason I had Stanfield so high, just looking at, you know, five Pro Bowls, five times All Pro, two NFL championships, the all 1950s Hall of Fame team, you know, just that was sort of I was enamored with those numbers, and that's sort of why I was on a roll with the Hall of Famers, and I said, okay, they got to be the top four. And they were all so good.
I just think that the Bubba Baker story is a very interesting story to me. As we sit here and do this episode of Pigskin Dispatch, I'm actually now more intrigued by Bubba's story as to why he's not in the Hall of Fame, and at worst, not in the Hall of Very Good. It's, you know, he was a sack machine. His numbers are...
Sounds like a future episode of Sports Forgotten Heroes brewing here.
It could be. I got to take a look at that. It's very interesting to me.
Yeah, it definitely is. I hope you do that. I think that would be a great, great episode.
I might have to look at that.
Yeah. Okay. Now, so who did you have at seventh? I missed. That's the only one I missed writing down.
Roy Winston.
Winston. Okay. That's somebody else I did not have.
Yeah. Winston played for 15 years. Played linebacker for the Vikings all 15 of those years, 12 interceptions, 14 fumbles. He played from 62 through 76. So he helped the Vikings win their only championship they've ever won. And people are like, the Vikings won a championship? Yes, they actually were the NFL champions in 1969. This is when the NFL champion played the AFL champion. And he played in four Super Bowls. He played in Super Bowl IV, Super Bowl VIII, Super Bowl IX, Super Bowl XI. The Vikings were a really good team back then, and Winston was one of their leaders. And again, he was as tough as can be, a heck of a tackler. And in fact, his tackle on Larry Zonka in 1972 is considered to be one of the most devastating tackles of all time. And like Gifford did with Bednarik, Zonka did with Winston, saying that the hit that Winston put on him was legal. And I don't know if the word admired is correct, but respected Winston so much and appreciated Winston so much that when Larry Zonka was inducted into the Hall of Fame, he invited Winston to the ceremony.
Really? Huh. That is something.
Yeah. Yeah. So who'd you have at seven?
At seven, I had Dennis Hera, who I know you had down the list a little bit.
Yeah, I have him at eight.
And I think the two different folks that we had is I had Chris Samuels and Tommy Nobis, and yours was Unger and Winston.
And Winston.
Yeah, just – but all great players, though.
Yeah, so my number eight is Dennis Hera. Played guard for the Rams for all those years, 13 years, six times in the Pro Bowl. First team All-Pro 1986, what made the Rams 40th anniversary team, helped the Rams win the NFC West six times. Again, we're getting down into the weeds here. I mean, there's definitely some really good players that people could say we left off or you and I differ on. You have Chris Samuel, Tommy Nobis. DeBrickashaw Ferguson was a heck of a ball player. Brad Benson was a really good guard for 10 years. You know, Otis Sistrunk was a heck of a ball player. So Dan Alexander. So, you know, this is where we get into the weeds. But I remember Dennis Hera, and he was a fixture on that Rams line.
Yeah, I thought he was a great player. I mean, actually, I started he was up near the top, like right after the Hall of Famers at first, until I started getting into, you know, some of the more studying on, you know, the Bubba Bakers and the Granthams and that. So I moved him down the list a little bit. But, you know, two players that you said that was heartbreaking not putting on the list was Unger and DeBrickashaw Ferguson. Because I said, but boy, where do I fit them? I can't. You know, these other players, yeah. I think, are just – they're all special, but I could have picked 12 real easy. And I didn't even consider Winston, which you made a very convincing case for, because the reason I didn't choose him is he didn't have any Pro Bowls that I could find, and he didn't have any All-Pros, where the other guys all did.
For Winston, yeah. I just thought, you know, again, a guy who had a heck of a career, was a heck of a linebacker, played for the Vikings all those years. And, another one who you would say was a fixture. I don't know, just something about him just said to me, this guy deserves to be there.
Well, when you made a convincing case, and I sat there and I thought about it. I said, okay, why would this guy not make the Pro Bowl? And then I'm sitting here looking at the era he's playing in, and the linebackers are playing in his division. When you have Butkuses and Nitschke's and, you know, all the others in that black and blue division, right? There's a couple good reasons why maybe you don't make it. I know he was a left linebacker, but, you know, that's just two other teams that he played a lot against. So there was a lot of great linebackers in that era throughout the NFL, even though there was less teams then. But, And he's just one of those guys who's overlooked, and I overlooked him. But I'm glad you talked about him, and you made a very convincing case for him.
All right. My number nine, I can't do a list without a Giant on it.
But yeah, I was surprised. I did. I was surprised you had him at nine. I thought maybe he'd be like five or something.
Well, yeah, you know, I tried to make a case for him to be number one, but I just found these couple of guys that I thought deserved to be a little bit higher. You know, he was an anchor on an offensive line that won a Super Bowl, the Giants Super Bowl in 2007. And yeah, three-time Pro Bowler. He was just a solid ball player. Again, we're talking about guys whose numbers are just so hard to judge, because offensive linemen, I don't know how the NFL can ever put in a statistic that can help you judge the effectiveness of an offensive lineman. I don't know if there is a way to do it, but I think one of the great stories about Sean O'Hara is how overlooked he is in so many different facets of his career, beginning with playing at Rutgers, where he was a walk-on. He wasn't even recruited out of high school, and he wound up playing all 4 years for Rutgers. And then he wasn't drafted, and he was an undrafted free agent signed by the Browns. And midway through his rookie year of 2000, he breaks into the Browns lineup, and he plays in eight games and starts four of them. In 2001, played all 16 games, started four of them, and the Browns saw something in him. And in 2002, he became a regular full-time starter. So in 2002, played in 14 games, played in all 16 games, started all 16 games. 2003, started all 14 games that he appeared in. 2004, his first year, he signed as a free agent with the Giants, played in 12 games, started 12 games. 2005, played in 16, started 16. 2006, played in 15, started 15. And in 2007, 2008, and 2009, he started every single game, played every single game of the season. 2010 was his final year, got hurt, and after six games, hung up his cleats. Three times he was a Pro Bowler. Actually, he was a target one time in his career for a touchdown, caught the pass, scored the touchdown. Again, just a solid ball player, and I think worthy of being named one of the, you know, top 10 of all time wearing number 60. And he wore number 60 every year of his career.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. He was a very special player. Going back to what you said about, you know, what they could come up with statistics for offense alignment. I think, I don't know if you ever listened to SiriusXM NFL Radio. Pat Kerwin has a show with the quarterback Miller that used to play for the Bears and the Steelers. Jim Miller. But Pat Kerwin has, and I think he does a lot of these chartings himself. He watches a lot of game film, of course, because I don't know where else you can get it from. But he goes by the amount of penalties that they have, like holding calls and false starts that offensive linemen have. And he also has, I don't know how he does it other than charting, is, you know, pressures that the man he's assigned to block gets on the quarterback and sacks. He counts that against them.
I've heard that. I think that should somehow They should talk to Pat Kerwin and figure out how to make that an official stat. How many sacks you gave up, penalties, like you said. I think that that would be a telling statistic. And, you know, how many times you're able to open up a hole somehow for, you know, how many yards rushing through the hole that you opened up. I bet you there's a way to do it if somebody really put their mind to it and got the NFL to sign off on. I think it'd be a terrific way to measure the effectiveness of an offensive lineman.
Yeah, and I'm sure with all the stat people and analysis people that they have working for the NFL and for the other media outlets, I'm sure they could come up with something and have some kind of a formula to put in there, almost like a quarterback number, you know?
Yeah.
Like you said.
Yeah.
So, definitely O'Hara makes that list, though. Now,
go ahead.
I was going to say, now we got to sort of figure out, we have these people that we're different on. So that's sort of where our debate's probably going to come in.
Right. And my number 10 is one of those guys. I had Max Unger. And when I thought about it, I said, you know what? Max Unger wore 60 every year of his career. And centers just don't get enough credit. The guy was a stud center for a really good Seahawks team, and then a stud center for a really good New Orleans team, three times Pro Bowl, first team All Pro. He was solid. He really wasn't very highly rated coming out of college. He played for Oregon, and he was drafted in the second round, 49th overall. The Seahawks saw something in him, took a chance, and sure enough, it paid off. But again, it's just not a very easy position to judge statistically. But outside of an injury in 2010, you know, as a rookie playing right guard, he started all 16 games. He got hurt in 2010, but he started 15 games in 2011, all 16 in 2012, started 13 in 2013. Again, he got hurt, so he only played in six games in 2014. But his last 4 years, his 4 years with the Saints, all at center, out of 64 possible games, he played in 63, starting 63 of those games. So, he was good. He was really, really good. And the quarterbacks for whom he was, you know, at center for, they would say the same thing.
Now I agree with you. I mean, Unger's a great player, but this is why I sort of didn't put him on there. And I put somebody like Chris Samuel on. That's one of the ones that I had different from you. And Chris Samuel ended up having, you know, six Pro Bowls to his name and played on, you know, the Washington Redskins, his entire career, 9 years with Washington. And he too started every game that he played in, 141 starts, 141 games. Had a few injury seasons, especially at the end of his career, but he had six seasons where he started all 16 games. And, you know, I agree with you. The centers don't get enough love on these lists. Very, very few of them. I think we have some numbers in the mid 60s, 63 is one that comes up. I know we have a few centers that are popping up on the list. But you know, this is the blind side guy. You know, this is the quarterback's best friend, the left tackle, and six Pro Bowls in 9 years. I thought that was pretty substantial on a team that was, the Washington Redskins of the early 2000s. They were good, but they had their up and down years. But this guy was solid throughout, and that's one reason I chose him to be on the list.
Well, there's you know, one of the reasons I didn't is because They weren't that good a team. I'm a Giants fan, so I really didn't like him. Not as a great person, just he was the enemy. But, you know, they weren't that good a team. And despite the fact that he was a left tackle, was a Pro Bowler, their offense wasn't that good. I mean, but that could also be a product of the quarterbacks they had at the time. You know, Mark Brunell at the end of his career, Jason Campbell, who, you know, was not an all-pro quarterback. So those were some of the reasons that I didn't pick Chris Samuels. And I thought that you know, I think they even had Patrick Ramsey at quarterback. They just weren't, you know, maybe that's not a fair assessment because of the team he played on, but Unger, I thought, played for better teams. That was a center, and Samuels was a left tackle. And I never, you know, I never looked at, again, very difficult to tell how many sacks he gave up. But played for Washington. Yeah. That's pretty tough.
But well, I'm sure you probably have the same argument for Tommy Nobis, because you didn't have him on your list, right? Correct? That was the other one we had different?
Yeah, Tommy Nobis.
Samuels and Nobis were my two that I had different for you. I mean, Nobis, you know, as long as we're talking about it, you know, 5 Pro Bowls, one time as an All-Pro, all 1960s Hall of Fame team, but played for the Falcons in the late 60s, you know, early 70s. Yeah, so
he was a heck of a ball player too. 12 interceptions, ran 2 back for touchdowns, 13 fumble recoveries. There is a very strong argument for Tommy Nobis, played middle linebacker for the Falcons. I could put Nobis in at number 10. Darn if offensive linemen just don't get as much credit as they should, or not credit, the recognition.
You're right.
That they deserve.
Yeah, you're right. Okay, so all right, let's review this here. So your two different ones are that I didn't have are Winston and Unger. Mine are Nobis and Samuels.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have compelling cases here.
For both.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm willing to call truce here, and we go with 12 on our list.
I think that's very fair. I think it'd be very difficult to say that Unger, and you know, you could call it a draw between Unger and Samuels, and you could call it a draw between Winston and Nobis. Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. So I think probably that's the gentlemanly way to settle this here, I think. And we'll just put 12 on the list. And, hey, it's our list, so we can do what we want with it,
we
right?
Do whatever we want.
Or we're taking our ball and going home. So, hey, that's a great job on there. I mean, that was probably one of the more challenging ones that I've seen this year, because there were some great players.
Because a lot of offensive linemen on there. If Otto Graham hadn't wore 60, I think it would have been easy to put Chuck Bednarik in number one. But we had some really, really good football players on there, beginning with Otto Graham, a guy who I don't think he gets the credit he deserves or the recognition that he should get. I mean, 7 championships in 10 years. I mean, what a quarterback.
That's for sure. And, you know, and just think about who we're leaving off this. And we mentioned him earlier, DeBrickashaw Ferguson, you know, 3-time Pro Bowler DeBrickashaw Ferguson, 10 years in a league, never missed a game, and started every game, 160 games in 10 years, and didn't make that list of the top 12. That's how many good players there are when we're in number 60.
One huge knock against him. He played for the Jets.
That wasn't me saying that. So Jets fans.
But no, I mean, the guy was a stud player. I mean, you know what? He played, 10 years? How many years did he play?
10 years.
10 years. Started every single game he played in.
Every game on the schedule.
Every game on the schedule. If there was a game, DeBrickashaw Ferguson played in that game.
And 7 playoff games.
Without a doubt, a great player. And you know what? If you wanted to, you could make the list 13 and put him on there.
That's probably fair enough. We can't leave a guy like that off. The more I think about it,
he was without a doubt.
When you're an Iron Man at offensive tackle, that's something special.
Yeah, these guys. I feel it's like there's no, and it really stinks. There's no statistical data that's readily available to judge their careers. A lot of this is from memory and from what you read. And yeah, he was great at Virginia too.
Yeah, he definitely was.
He was, he was the 4th overall pick in the draft.
That's for sure.
And lived up to it.
Now I think I might have an idea here because I'm going to be talking to, I have him scheduled, John Turney, who is sort of the founder of the Pro Football Journal. And John told me in a conversation we had that he's got stats on for linemen and some defensive linemen and sacks, pre-1982, that he's gone back and looked at scorecards and watched, game films and things on. So he's got some interesting numbers, and I'd be interested to see, what he turns up and what we can talk to him about. Maybe he's got some answers to some of these lineman questions that we have.
Wouldn't it be great to have a job like that where you could just let's get some film out and check it out. Man, what a great job.
Yeah, he sure does. Him, and I know Chris Willis works with him quite a lot, who's with NFL Films library. He's the head of their library, so I'm sure he has some good access there with Willis helping him there. So definitely. Both good guys. I enjoyed talking to them. So we have our list of 13, and I think it's a pretty good list, and I'm kind of proud of that. That's some great players there.
Again, a lot of fun doing this with you. It's always fun to uncover some of the unknowns, like Bubba's barbecue ribs and Bubba's boneless ribs and things like that. It's a lot of fun to go back through here and just to talk football, man. This is what it's all about, these podcasts. It's just so much fun to talk to the guests we have on here, to reminisce, and the research to find out different stories and facts and figures and things. I got an interview coming up about a baseball player by the name of Monty Pearson. And, like I've told you before, I like to try and stay season relevant. So I'm in the middle right now of baseball, but starting to play in football, as that's not that far around the corner. And actually, I have some pretty good ones that I'm talking about, but I'm not going to reveal them. But Monty Pearson, I would venture to say that very few people, particularly listening to your podcast right now, because I know very few that listen to my podcast, Sports Forgotten Heroes, would really know much of the story about Monty Pearson, who was a baseball pitcher first for the Cleveland Indians and then for the New York Yankees. And when he was with the Yankees, he appeared in four World Series games as the starting pitcher for the New York Yankees. I'm going to tell you his stats. In 1936, he pitched in one game in the World Series. It was a complete game, and he won that game. In 1937, made one appearance for the New York Yankees in the World Series. He pitched 8 2/3 innings and won the game. In 1938, again, one start, pitched all nine innings and won the game. And in 1939, made one start, pitched all nine innings and won the game. So his career record in the World Series is four games pitched. He's 4-0, three complete games. His ERA is 1.01, and out of a possible 36 innings, he pitched 35 2/3 innings. And you remember guys like, you know, Whitey Ford pitched for the Yankees, not at that time, but, Lefty Grove. I mean, you had great, great pitchers for the Yankees. Red Ruffing was their big stud. Marius Russo, Spud Chandler. They had great pitchers, but no one remembers Monty Pearson.
Is that why he only had one game in his series? Is he like their number three or number four pitcher?
No, because they would win the series in four or five games. Those were World Series games. His actual records in those 4 years, in 1936, he was 19-7. In 1937, he was 9-3. In 1938, he was 16-7. And in 1939, he was 12-5. He was one of their top four starters. He was great.
Reason I was asking that, because usually, your ace, even, unless you win it in four, but usually the ace pitchers on the winning teams will at least have two starts. If it goes to five games or six games, they get a couple starts.
Yeah, back then they still, and don't forget, they also had Lefty Gomez, not Lefty Grove, Lefty Gomez. And they would win these series in four games. They would sweep these series. In those 4 years, in 1936, they won the series in six games. In 36, that was over the Giants. In 37, they won it in five games over the Giants. In 38, they swept the Cubs. And in 39, they swept the Reds. So he only had a chance to pitch one game in each series.
Yeah, still, that's unbelievable. 35 2/3 innings, but possible 36 outs. Mm-hmm. Only missed one out in all of his starts. Series. So, wow, that's amazing.
Well, that'll be a fun podcast.
And I'll bet you he was miffed when he was taken out for that one out too.
Yeah, probably.
Pitchers never want to leave the mound.
He gave up a run. I'm going to have to find out why he was lifted in that one particular game.
I hope it wasn't like a 6-1 score or something too. He was pulled in. Sounds like a great podcast. I'll be looking forward to that. And I'm sure the listeners will be too. And, once again, Warren, I want to thank you for your time and the knowledge that you brought into these Jersey number 60s and some of these great stories that you told, with the Bubba's boneless ribs and like you mentioned, and some of the other ones. That's some great stuff. And appreciate you coming on. And I think we have you on for more. I know we had a conversation about you, Jersey 58. I don't know if you heard it, with I had Dan and Andrew Newman on, who are also – they're also Giants fans. And this is sort of the gist of the conversation. It was on air and they were talking, sort of ribbing me at the end. They're like going, "Hey, you know, we got 58, but we're Giants fans. And, you know, we were trying to get, you know, 10 and 11. We couldn't get it. Warren Rogan got it. And we tried 53 and 56. We couldn't because Warren Rogan got it." He goes, "But we did get 89 over him." I said, "Yeah." I said, "And Warren's pissed at you guys. He wanted Bavaro."
So. Yeah, he was what a great tight end that guy was, and turncoat went to the Eagles. Oh my gosh!
Well, Warren, I won't take up any more of your time. I appreciate your time. I know you're down there. Hopefully, missing this big storm that's hitting your area of the woods down there. And hopefully it does miss you and you stay safe down there. But we appreciate you coming on once again and enlightening us with this great football knowledge you have.
Thank you so much, Darren. My pleasure. I enjoy it.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.